This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the world looks on in wonder as the movement against police repression grows by leaps and bounds in the United States. Al Sharpton's role as the White House's favorite Black person looks shakier by the day. And Mumia Abu-Jamal speaks of his daughter, who passed away last week. But first, President Obama announced that the United States would move to establish normal diplomatic relations with Cuba after 55 years of repeatedly trying to overthrow its socialist government. One immediate upshot was the release of three of the Cuban Five, who were imprisoned by the United States back in 1998 after infiltrating American-based terrorist operations against Cuba. Two of the Cubans were already free, having served out their sentences. Netfa Freeman is a longtime member of the International Committee for Freedom of the Cuban Five. He says the United States is still up to no good in Cuba, Latin America, and the world.
I think that people in Obama's administration have decided that this is just another way to overthrow the Cuban Revolution. And so that's what they're trying to do, I think. I mean, you can see it in Obama's speech. Everything he said was that they were still have the same disposition about Cuba, but they just want to change how they go about destabilizing it. And the Cubans are no fools. I'm sure they realize this. And so because the United States government is still having this disposition, the blockade, we call it a blockade. It's not just an embargo. It's a blockade. It's an act of war. It's an isolation because they're not sure how much they can get Cuba to capitulate to what their issues are. They have a revolution that's been lasting ever since 1959. And so they're very clear on the stakes. They're very clear on their principles, the humanitarian and internationalist principles. And I think also they realize, and people should realize, that the credibility of the United States is waning. It has waned for quite some time. And there's so much hypocrisy in terms of United States policy, foreign policy, and domestic policy. Here you hear Obama talking about not having people beaten in the streets, talking about Cuba, where here, every 28 hours, a person is shot by the police, killed by the police, not to mention who's beaten by the police, for not even for political beliefs, just for being a particular race. And so this is the kind of hypocrisy that should be evident when people listen to the speeches and the pronouncements from the U.S. government. It doesn't matter whether it's Obama or any other president. Any president of the United States is the president of imperialism.
There is some anxiety among activists here in the United States that a rapprochement between Washington and Havana could lead to the handing back of political refugees such as Assata Shakur. Do you think there's any possibility of that?
No, I don't think the Cuba would betray their principles in terms of their assistance to people and the people that have asylum, like Assata. The only thing that they could hope for is because, one, they have a bounty on Assata's head, so it's she's not even safe under the current conditions. She hasn't been, so it's not like she can't be subjected to somebody sneaking into Cuba and arranging for them to kidnap her and take her away. But that would have to be how it happened. The Cubans would never, I don't believe, that they would ever negotiate and consider giving up Assata or anyone else who has asylum.
Are these latest developments evidence of the United States confronting its isolation in the world over the Cuba issue?
Part of it is the fact that they're realizing that they're isolated. And also, their standing in the world is also not just about how people see its foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, but also domestic policy. Right now we're seeing a movement of young people who are taking a stand against us being murdered by police, and everyone in the world is seeing that. And so, yes, they have to consider that they're being scrutinized and that their credibility is waning internationally. A lot of it is trying to create a different strategy and a different angle to get at Cuba. And also Cuba itself, its example around the world, exposes and shines a bigger mirror on the contradictions and the hypocrisy of the United States. Because unlike the United States, when the United States sends occupying soldiers, Cuba sends doctors and teachers and things like that. Their assistance in Africa around the Ebola epidemic has stood in stark contrast to how the United States has responded. They responded with a military solution to a disease, which is ridiculous. And so much of their credibility is waning, and I think they're reaching for some way to reestablish their credibility but not give up their hegemony around the world. And those things are contradictory. You're going to actually have to actually contribute to humanity if you want to change it, but they're still trying to fake it.
That was Netfa Freeman of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly recently returned from Moscow, where she attended an international conference as part of a delegation from UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. The conference was hosted by the Anti-Globalization Movement of Russia, but much of the talk was about the movement against police violence against blacks in the United States.
They are, as their name says, mostly concerned with the sovereignty of Russia and other countries around the world and promoting a multipolar world. But as part of that mission, they are very much interested in human rights around the world, and particularly in the United States now with police brutality. I believe that people in Russia had a more favorable view of life in the United States and were shocked about Michael Brown's killing, about the fact that the police officer was not punished, and about the scale of protests in Ferguson and around the country. The small suburb of St. Louis is now known around the world, and the people of Ferguson have really done an amazing thing in telling the world the truth about life in the United States, particularly for black people, and how it bears no resemblance to the image that the U.S. cultivates.
You say that your impression was that the people in Russia, at least the ones you met, had a more favorable view of race relations in the United States. Well, where would they get that kind of view?
From Obama's election. The questions about Ferguson were also related to Obama and what he has or has not done for black people. I think having a black president was a revolutionary thing, at least the image, the idea of it, not the fact of it, obviously. So I think there is shock. The election of this man seemed to signify that black Americans had reached a point of equal treatment and a true democracy. So I think Obama's election had a great deal to do with the shock that people there have experienced as they learn about this case.
Well, I guess you felt obligated to give them an instant political education.
I did, both at the conference and in interviews with Russian media. I pointed out that not only is racism sadly alive and well, but that America is not the democracy that it claims to be. Aside from having the ability to vote periodically, the interests of the average American are not represented in Congress or on the agenda at the White House or in local legislatures around the country.
Now, you weren't the only non-Russians involved with this conference. Did you speak to other people from around the world, and what did they think about U.S. race relations?
There was a group from Italy representing the European Communitarian Party, people from Serbia, from Ukraine, from Moldova, and they were all very, very interested in Ferguson, and I think were similarly surprised and had a misapprehension about the reality of life here.
Well, what did you observe in Russia in terms of their relations among races and ethnicities and nationalities?
Well, Russia is a multi-ethnic society. There are people from a variety of the former Soviet republics living in Russia, many Asian people from Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan. I met people who had some ancestry from Georgia and Moldova and other regions that, whilst there's no longer a Soviet Union, they still obviously have a connection with Russia. I did see just a handful of African people, African-descended people, not many, but I did not notice any difference of treatment for myself or those other people.
Now, you were hosted by the anti-globalization movement of Russia, and their worst nightmare appears to have become true. That is, outside economic and political forces have intruded in an aggressive manner and brought the ruble to about half its value and created a grave crisis for the Russian economy.
Yes, I was there for only 4 full days, and from the day I arrived, there were 55 rubles to a dollar. When I left, there were 80 to a dollar, and that was before the great decline in their currency that occurred a couple of days ago. The United States and Saudi Arabia have connived to lower energy prices around the world, which is extremely harmful to Russia. Russia is a major energy, gas and oil producer, also Venezuela as well. So this punishes countries that won't knuckle under to the United States, which it appears won't be happy, our government, until it runs the entire world. Bush came out and said, you're either with us or against us. Obama, being smoother and slicker, won't say those words, but that's clearly still American foreign policy, is to bring every country of the world under America's heel. And you do that by destroying those countries that have any kind of power, as in the case of Russia as an energy producer. The Russian president remains defiant and held a more than 2-hour-long press conference a couple of days ago. So he and others in his government obviously are not going to just collapse at the American onslaught, but it has to be doing great damage to them. And in addition, America's reaching out to Cuba is, it seems to me, obviously a means of getting Cuba back into America's orbit, because while Obama says he will end sanctions against Cuba, they increase them on Venezuela and increase them on Crimea, formerly part of Ukraine, which voted to become part of Russia, and increase sanctions on Russia. So Uncle Sam gives with one hand, not in an honest way, however, and takes with the other.
Isn't that something? So that all over Latin America, and certainly all over the U.S. corporate media, people are talking about an end to the Cold War, when it appears that the new phase of that war is heating up right now, simultaneously.
Yes, it is, and it's very shrewd. I have to give credit for the slickness of the evil doing. But, you know, Americans know so little about the rest of the world, and if the president says he's going to normalize relations with Cuba, but not point out that he can't end the embargo without congressional approval, and it's unclear that that really will happen, so it's partly some smoke and mirrors going on. One can't complain about the Cuban Five, all of the Cuban Five being freed. That's obviously a just thing, but it proves that that could have been done all along. There was no reason for those men to have been in jail for years. This president and his predecessors could have freed them at any time. So their suffering was for naught. But normalizing relations with Cuba is something that people who want a democratic world have long sought, but it is not coming from a place of honesty. And I think it's obvious that this is a way to get at Russia. President Putin had announced several months ago that there would be forgiveness of loans and financial aid to the Cuban economy. So this is a way to try to keep cutting and cutting and cutting the number of countries that are able to be independent of the United States.
And what's happening to Russia should be a cautionary tale to Cubans who want to become more engaged and involved with the United States, that the more engaged and involved you are with the U.S., the more vulnerable you become to the U.S.'s economic machinations.
Yes, Cuba is in a difficult position, having been forced to be an impoverished country because of the United States. So this is something that they, I'm sure, have long sought, but they must be very careful that the United States does not use this to keep punishing Cuba, to make Cuba an American colony once again, the way it was for over 100 years before the Cuban Revolution. This assistance will come, and the diplomatic relations will clearly come with strings attached. the goal is to subjugate Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and all the Latin American countries that in recent years have elected leftist governments and are asserting their rights of sovereignty to be free of U.S. interests. So there is no way that this American president or any other president wants relations with Cuba, which will really benefit Cuba. So it is, frankly, a perilous time for that country.
And in fact, just a few weeks before this rapprochement with Cuba, the United States was pushing renewed additional sanctions against Cuba's best friend in Latin America, Venezuela.
Yes, obviously, it's galling to the United States that the Venezuelan people have elected again and again and again, repeatedly, first the late President Hugo Chavez, now Nicolas Maduro, leftist governments who want only to be independent of the United States and to be a sovereign nation and to use their oil wealth to benefit their people without American influence. But this is unacceptable to the United States, which has been trying ever since Chavez was elected to overthrow that government, to weaken it, to destabilize it, making common cause with the Bolivarian Revolution's enemies within that country. And it is very galling for the sanctions to be imposed. There's an accusation of the Venezuelans being undemocratic with their own people, but it is the United States that is fomenting much of the violence that took place this year in Venezuela. Venezuela threw Cuba a lifeline after the Soviet Union collapsed and kept that economy from imploding completely. So the goal of President Obama and the goal of his successor, I'm sure, will be to destroy the Bolivarian Revolution and get Venezuela back into the fold and be an American, a de facto colony once again.
To return to the United States and its racial situation, we're now in the holiday season with a new year before us. Do we begin this year with something that people could rationally call a movement afoot?
It has the potential to be, it's the beginning of a movement. I'm a little concerned, frankly, that there has not been a very simple demand made to the Obama administration to prosecute these killer cops, to prosecute Darren Wilson. It is not true. It is a lie to say that the bar is too high and the Justice Department, which when it wants to get someone, does it quite simply, that they cannot prosecute Darren Wilson, the killer of Michael Brown, or other killer cops around the country. That has to be a central part of the demand of these protests. So I'm a little concerned that point has not been reached. So this has great potential, but I think sometimes people forget that the point of mass demonstrations, the point of mass protests, is to make political demands, and that has to be one of them.
Yes, we remember the Liberty City defendants, indigent men who've been charged with terrorist acts like plotting to bomb the Sears Tower. We remember that the United States prosecuted them three times before they could get a conviction. It didn't back off because of the bar being too high for a jury to see over.
Yes, the government does what it wants to do. The Liberty City case is one of many where agent provocateurs were used to entrap people and then to result in prosecutions for accusations of terrorism. I remember the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was murdered, assassinated by the American government, who made up some heretofore unknown claim that the Constitution doesn't give us the right to due process as we've thought for a couple of hundred years. When they want to get somebody, they change the rules, they make up what they want to. Prosecutors go back and back again to make sure they get who they want to get. So when they claim that the bar is too high in these cases, it is absolute nonsense. It is not to be believed, and it has to be a central part of the demand of the protest.
In fact, you've said that the demand for prosecution should be all that the protesters should have to say to the Obama administration.
Very simply, yes. You know, the hands up, don't shoot. I'd just say add the word prosecute. Hands up, don't shoot, prosecute. And that has to be said over and over again. In the case of Michael Brown, of Eric Garner, of John Crawford, of Tamir Rice, And I could go on and on with people whose names we have not come to hear. The federal government can and must play the role in prosecuting these cases. There is no political will in local or state governments around the country to do anything. And the Justice Department has the capability of doing this. Let's not forget, after the not guilty verdicts and the beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles back in 1992, it was the Bush Justice Department who successfully prosecuted the police who had been acquitted previously. And I find it hard to believe that George Bush can prosecute and Barack Obama cannot. If he doesn't prosecute, it's because he does not want to.
Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly in New York. Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo is a bar editor and columnist in Washington, D.C. She's also a noted whistleblower and an activist with the Hands Up Coalition, D.C. Coleman Adebayo's article in the current issue of Black Agenda Report describes how young activists demanded to be heard at Reverend Al Sharpton's recent rally in the nation's capital.
The title of this article is Let Us Speak, Let Us Speak, Let Us Speak. And the reason why I repeated those words over and over again, because that was the chant that became, I believe, the central piece, the central cry of the rally. It was interesting because what happened is that this was a rally that, as you know, was organized by the Reverend Al Sharpton in conjunction with other organizations. And Margaret Kimberly did a fabulous job in her article in Black Agenda the week before that this was a rally that was being put together in collaboration with the Obama administration to try to get ahead of the movement, to try to take some of the wind out of the movement, to try to steer the movement in a particular direction, and to coordinate Reverend Al Sharpton as its leader. And so it had all the elements of an organization, of a march, that central focus was to enshrine that the Obama administration was doing the very best it could do, that it supported the goals and mission of this rally, and that Reverend Al Sharpton was in charge of the direction of this movement. After all, we had just seen him sitting next to President Obama at the roundtable meeting that was held at the White House. So it had all the characteristics of a political kabuki theater, and we were going to sort of be the cast of that theater. And so a lot of us had a lot of misgivings about going to and participating in this kind of theater that was going to be sort of laid out in the streets of Washington, D.C. And then something spectacular, I think I called it miraculous, happened at this rally. We had the same usual traditional leaders, Michael Eric Dyson, who spoke about how brilliant our president is and what a great leader he is, and really spent a considerable amount of time patting Barack Obama on the back. We had Zionists. I think the first speaker was actually a Zionist speaker in this rally, the pre-rally at Freedom Plaza, who sort of talked about the relationship between blacks and Jews and how important it was, you know, that blacks and Jews continued this march that we started during the Civil Rights Movement. And you could hear the discontent. I mean, I was walking through the crowds, and you can hear them saying, what the heck? What is she talking? I mean, you can literally hear people making comments about why do they have this woman on the stage talking about things that are, quite frankly, not that central to the Ferguson struggle. And so it was a very, very interesting process that was going on between the people and the crowds. And then all of a sudden there was this, what I guess Sharpton likes to call it, a disturbance. And I was in the press area by this time. So I was on that little platform in Freedom Plaza. And all of a sudden, one of my colleagues, who's in our coalition, Erica Totten, went to this podium and she took the microphone from the organizers. And she was talking to someone who's very well known in Washington, D.C. And she said, you know, the youth of Ferguson you know, have come to Washington, D.C. to voice their concerns, and we have to let them speak. Well, the person who was at the microphone was clearly upset about this. You know, first of all, there's this young lady who he didn't know who was grabbing the microphone from his hand and was demanding that someone who was not on the certified list be allowed to speak. So there was clear discord at that point. And then even a threat came out, which was, if you guys don't stop what you're doing, I'm going to go to the hotel. I'm going to get Michael Brown Sr. to come out. And no one has suffered as much as he has. And if he tells you to basically sit down and be quiet, that's what you need to do. But the youth by that time had started to chant, let us speak, let us speak, let us speak. And then as people, sort of the rumors in the crowd began to circulate about what was going on, everyone joined in to let us speak, let us speak, let us speak. At that point, I think Reverend Al Sharpton was alerted. He came to Freedom Plaza. He is really good politically. I just have to note this, because he saw that the direction of the crowd had turned in a particular direction, and he pivoted. He pivoted so adeptly, and he said, okay, we're going to let two or three of these Ferguson people, youth from Ferguson, speak. What I didn't know until I spoke to Erica later was that he had actually gotten their permission, had gotten their consent, I suppose, that they wouldn't, quote-unquote, call for violence against non-whites at the rally, and that they were going to be peaceful and all that, to call for peace and tranquility and all that.
As if they had had any intention of doing so.
You know, well, I wonder where did he get that from, because as you know, it's MSNBC, CNN, the police force that kept saying that the youth of Ferguson were so violent. So where in the world did he get the idea that the youth of Ferguson were going to call for riots or violence against the people there? I mean, it's extraordinary. And that is the reason why, in fact, this kind of rhetoric that's coming out of the administration, whether it's in Washington or the state governments, about how violent we are and that we have to, you know, be controlled by tear gas and rubber bullets, you know, I mean, that is the rhetoric coming out of the people in power towards black people. So why he felt that he would have to talk to these young folks about this, I thought was obscene, quite frankly. So they took the microphone. They gave fabulous talks about what was happening on the ground in Ferguson, the need for solidarity with the folks in Ferguson, and asking for everybody to continue the struggle for freedom in this country. Much more important discussions than any of the speakers that they had originally lined up, quite frankly. And that theme, because of what the youth of Ferguson did at Freedom Plaza, it really colored the rest of the program. And it was clear that they were making changes because something dynamic had occurred that was not expected, that the people demanded to speak. The youth of Ferguson demanded to speak. And it was a very dynamic moment. I think the White House at this point will have to sit back at some point and re-strategize, rethink, in the light of what happened at Freedom Plaza, whether or not Reverend Al Sharpton is still the right person to carry their water. Because what became very clear was that he has no organic relationship to the struggle that's happening in the streets of Ferguson, New York, and Washington, D.C. And that's going to be a very interesting discussion at the White House and the power centers around the country, because that would also mean that now they're going to be on the lookout for someone to take his place, if my analysis is correct. And then we have to be very curious and we have to be very keen on understanding how the White House is also going to pivot on this issue. But I think that it was an important rally, and I'm really glad I went, because I really saw the kind of power that is centralized in the struggle in Ferguson.
Yes, it sounds like the rally, as Sharpton had planned it to be, was not designed to speak truth to power, but to buttress and support those in power.
Michael Eric Dyson, I think, becomes central to this issue, because Michael Eric Dyson is younger than Reverend Al Sharpton. He has more of the vocabulary of a youth than does Reverend Al Sharpton. And seemingly, you know, he might, on a very superficial level, be more acceptable. Doesn't have as much baggage as someone like Reverend Al Sharpton. So whether or not the administration will now begin to look to him to carry more of their water on this issue is yet to be seen. But one of the ways that I think he pivoted once we marched to the Capitol from Freedom Plaza, instead of him giving what I thought was going to be his I Have a Dream speech, you know, in the shadow of the U.S. Capitol, he basically stood back and allowed the victims, the parents and the family members of the people who had died to speak. And I think that that was a direct result of what had happened at Freedom Plaza, because I think he realized that people really were not interested in hearing what he had to say, that they wanted to hear from the families of the people who had lost their loved ones. So there's no question that the administration, I think, is searching for a way of getting out front on this issue. They're looking for people who can carry their water. They're trying to decide in the context or the framework of their own limitations, which is that they're going to support the police forces in these communities, because those are the people who are protecting property. Those are the people who are protecting the status quo. So they can't altogether throw police under the bus, because they need them to protect the power structure and people who are in power and U.S. businesses. But at the same time, they're trying to figure out how can we get someone to quote-unquote talk sense to the people who are in the street now. And I think that that's the challenge confronting those who are in power right now, is how do we clamp down, how do we take control of the movement, and how do we provide a leader that will be accepted among the youth of Ferguson and New York and Washington and Georgia.
You speak of Al Sharpton as being out front in the effort to take the wind out of the sails of this new movement, but it's not just Sharpton, it's the NAACP, the right. National Urban League.
Right, it's all of the traditional power brokers who stand to make a lot of money, quite frankly, from this movement. And that's what's always interesting about these movements, I suppose, is that when you see what's happening in Ferguson, how they're hiring this black person to be the chief of that, another black person, is that a lot of people are making a lot of money from the suffering and the anguish of these communities. And the people on the ground, of course, you know, are waiting to see if the activities that we're all involved in are going to be able to shift the momentum away from the power structures and the people in power back to local communities, and really having an effective dialogue about the abuse that is taking place, the murders that are taking place of our youth in all of these in the communities around the country. The Hands Up Coalition DC, we hold demonstrations in front of the Department of Justice every Monday at 4 p.m. And one of the painful events that happens almost every week at the rally is that someone will tap me on the shoulder, and it will be a mother or it will be a father, and they will say, "My son was killed by police, and I heard about your rally and decided to come down to Washington," or, you know, wherever they're coming from, just to see if I could get some help, if I could get support, if someone could pray for me, because I am in deep pain. So what we're involved in now is really creating a mass movement that has some fundamental demands that the system is relying on people like Al Sharpton and the NAACP and Urban League and all the rest of these traditional organizations to try to divert attention away from basic demands about who controls the black community, who controls the wealth of the black community. Fundamentally, and that's human resources, but who controls the wealth of the black community? Do we have a right to feel safe and secure in our own homes when we have police knocking down our doors and literally killing our children in front of our eyes? So there's some fundamental demands. You know, why is it that we have civil rights provisions in the Department of Justice where the bar is so high that even when states fail, the Department of Justice cannot step in and provide justice, provide some legal redress so that parents and communities can feel as though there's some justice in the legal system. And so they need these organizations to provide a diversion away from people asking very fundamental questions about whether capitalism can meet the needs of black people in this country. And so if you look at MSNBC, CNN, there's always a representative there from the NAACP or Urban League or Reverend Sharpton, who has his own show for, I think, obvious reasons. And so it's up to our community now to use social media, to use news magazines like Black Agenda Report, to try to counter these arguments and to have a constructive dialogue that makes sense in light of the attack that our community is facing right now.
But as you described at the march in Washington, lots of young people don't have a deference for these old-line civil rights organizations and preachers like folks used to.
No, that's true. And so that's the challenge. That is the challenge that this administration is facing. And it's interesting how they keep blowing off their toe because, as you will recall, there was one youth in particular who participated in that roundtable at the White House. His name is Rasheen Aldridge, but he didn't go along with the program. He literally criticized the president during the roundtable discussion. He made a demand that the president step out and talk, confront the issue of racism, white supremacy in this country, and went on TV and was very articulate in terms of what he wanted to see the president do to address the problems that black youth are facing in this country. And within a week, they had trumped up charges against him. And now, of course, his ankles have been duct taped together because he's trying to avoid becoming a part of the prison industrial complex, becoming incarcerated. So the White House clearly is making an example out of him to say, you know, it is not permissible for you to question and to, quote unquote, I suppose, embarrass the President of the United States. The White House is confronted with major challenges, but the youth of this country are on the move, and this is the most exciting movement that has occurred in this country since the Civil Rights Movement. And so I would just ask everyone to go to our website, which is handsupcoalitiondc.com, or go to fergusonaction.com, find an action near your home, get involved in some way, because everyone can do something. One of my mentors, Reverend Walter Fauntleroy, used to always say to us and say to organizations and to groups, if everyone does a little, no one has to do a lot. So it's incumbent upon all of us to do our part, whatever that is, whether it's sending a check into the local Hands Up Coalition in your area, writing an article about this issue, whatever it is, going to a demonstration, but it's important for everyone to do something to support this movement.
Bar editor and columnist Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo. Although the infamous stop and frisk police policy in New York City has officially been halted, Mayor Bill de Blasio's police commissioner, Bill Bratton, is aggressively pushing his so-called broken windows philosophy of policing, which calls for arrests for the most minor infractions of the law. Josmar Trujillo is with a group called New Yorkers Against Bratton. They've been holding demonstrations and other actions, pointing out that Eric Garner was a victim of Bill Bratton's broken windows policy. In other words, broken windows is a killer.
The unfortunate thing about cases like Eric Garner's is they just bring to light things that have been going on quietly beneath the headlines for years, and it takes choking deaths on video to really get the media to pay attention to what people in the streets have been saying for as long as I've been alive, which is that the police state that communities of color live in is literally killing people. And we have so many names in addition to Eric Garner. We have Akai Gurley recently in Brooklyn. And then we have, from 20 years ago, Nicholas Hayward Jr., Anthony Baez, so many that, of course, it had to happen, that eventually the streets would just be outpouring with emotion and demands for something different. So we have to hold the city, the politics in this country accountable, and we can't stop until we do.
What's New Yorkers Against Bratton been doing to combat broken windows?
When the appointment of Bill Bratton was announced, we made sure that from the very beginning, no one can really deny what Bill Bratton has meant to the history of New York and what broken windows theory has meant to this city for at least the last 20 years. And it's an idea, and it's an ideology, a theory, philosophy, what have you, that's been exported to cities across the country. So we've been making sure that we kept up the pressure on not only Bratton, but on the mayor who appointed him, the political establishment in this city that said nothing, that sat on their hands, knowing what Bill Bratton's history was. And we've been consistent with our message that having Bill Bratton here is incompatible with any rhetoric that any politician might throw out there. And so we're here just to point out the obvious, the elephant in the room, which is that these self-proclaimed progressive politicians are failing us. And that's another front that I think needs to be fought as we fight against the police state, is the political institutions and the politics around the police state that allow these things to keep happening.
It seems that broken windows has the same effect and maybe the same intent as stop and frisk. That is, it creates many, many more encounters with police and chances for police to pull young black and brown people into the system.
I'd even say more, go further and say stop and frisk was just really an extension or the tip of the iceberg on the broken windows, the larger iceberg. That's really the foundation from beginning in the 90s when Bill Bratton put it in. And some people will also point out that stop and frisk, as demeaning, as harassing, as outrageous as that practice was, I've been stopped and I got to go home at the end of the day, or at the end of the encounter, luckily. With broken windows types of interactions, which are, of course, just ways to get police into the lives of black and brown poor people specifically, you don't walk away necessarily. You actually don't walk away at all. You either get arrested or you get a summons. So the punitive price, the larger share of the punitive price is actually with the broken windows interactions than even stop and frisk. So stop and frisk looks tame in comparison to what's been going on for at least 20 years. And I'll say at least because police have always been in our lives before this theory came to practice. But this theory has basically codified that racism that we've lived with for so many generations. So broken windows is the logical next step, and we have to unearth those ideas completely to even have the conversation of something being different.
So in that kind of sense, you seem to be saying that Bill de Blasio, New York's mayor, who's heralded as a big progressive nationally, actually was taking a step backward by bringing back Bill Bratton, the architect of broken windows, and which then begat stop and frisk.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. I'm sure for business elites in this city, it was taking a step forward in terms of their interest, because Bill Bratton doesn't only mean the continuation of the status quo of broken windows and everything that entails, but he's not here just to warm the seat of power. He's here to figure out new, innovative ways to get into our lives that we'll probably be fighting for the next 20 years. One of the things he's talked about pretty openly is predictive policing, which is basically a broken windows or proactive policing type approach that's just muscled up with the technology that's now available. So whether it's, he's handing out these tablets to the NYPD, that's going to make it much more what he would call efficient ways of policing. They're thinking of computer algorithms that are going to predict where crime will occur, which we know is another way of saying we're going to continue to see communities of color spotlighted. So it's not just what he has meant for the last 20 years, it's what his reign in New York, whether it's 1 year, whether it's the next 8 years potentially under de Blasio, what that's going to mean for future generations. So for us, that was the first shot fired with this mayor. And for business elites in the city, that's a step exactly towards what they want. They want to see us gentrified, out of the city, displaced. They want to see us criminalized. They want to keep the boot over our necks for as long as they can. And Bill Bratton is one of the foremost generals in that battle.
And have you been able to bring Mayor de Blasio and his supporters and apologists into this conversation?
Well, we've been pushing for that because I think that with the demonstrations that are going on, not only in New York but across the country, I think the next logical step would be to start putting some of those shut it down hashtags into the halls of power in the city. These men who come in and put these ideologies around, they're completely supported by these political establishments. So whether it's the alleged Sandinista communist Bill de Blasio here, or it's some other progressive sellout or phony on the West Coast or in between, these guys are the ones who are putting these ideas back in power. So we, you know, New Yorkers Against Braddon and our allies and the groups that are forming with us for a coalition against Broken Windows, we want civil disobedience. We want all of that disruption to not just occur, you know, in terms of traffic, but also in terms of the traffic of power. So city halls, the offices of city council members who supported Braddon, who support the ideology of Broken Windows, the mayors, the governors, all of these people are not only here amongst us. I mean, they have public hearings. We should be throwing ourselves on the gears of power right now.
And you've been resisting plans to add 1,000 new police to New York's 35,000 strong force.
That is the most ridiculous, outrageous thing I think that happened this year, besides Bill Bratton's going to be Bill Bratton. But these progressive city council members, starting with the speaker, Melissa Mark Viverito, they came in at the beginning of this year all kind of riding in on this on the coattails of the stop and frisk, quote-unquote, victory. And they came in here and they started asking for 1,000 new cops in the spring. And this goes back to this myth of Broken Windows, that the only way to solve any issues we have in our community is through putting boots on the ground or through guns and badges. The police have to solve all of our problems. And these city council members need to be held accountable for what they're saying. If they want to put cops into our communities, they can't go around and do these fake, phony protests around Eric Garner and, you know, pay condolences to that Guy Curley family and then put 1,000 new cops on the streets. That is completely unacceptable. And so we are adamant in that Melissa Mark Viverito and city council members who supported that have to answer for that, have to answer to the community right now, because Melissa Mark Viverito has not relented on calling that. She's probably a little bit less vocal about it now in the context of what's going on. We have to call these people out daily.
Do you think we have a different kind of political scenario in the country since August 9th, since Michael Brown was shot down?
I think that there are gatekeepers that are trying to keep us from really going that extra mile, keep us from really letting all of this anger and emotion get too far ahead of where they want to see it go. And that goes for elected officials, that goes for self-appointed misleadership class type of people like the Al Sharptons of the world. But there is no way that I think that at this moment that the everyday person can look at the political establishment right now as having any authority to tell us where this movement should go. They have largely failed, the ones who have been here for all this time, to really push for, you know, justice. So whether it's kind of trying to keep younger people out of the movement or whether it's trying to downplay and admonish radical politics, their influence is just diminishing every day. If we, as a movement, go back to the old power players, then we're going to get those old results again.
And do you see a new leadership emerging?
You know, I think in Ferguson, what those young people and what those people on the ground were able to show us is that you don't have to be an academic, professional activist. You don't have to be someone who has done this professionally in order to have a say in it. That you can come in, that regular people can be involved in the movement. And I think that's critically important. And I'm not going to say as a general rule just anyone new has the best ideas. There's an amazing amount of wisdom and power that comes from people who've done this before I was born. And so we have to acknowledge that too. But I think that having a movement where you're having people involved for the first time in their lives is critical. People who have two jobs and kids and who work for a living and who feel these effects, those are the people that really need to be involved. So whether that's just the average person coming to a protest for the first time and then slowly becoming involved, whether that's young people who have traditionally maybe have not had the same voice in it, it just has to be something different. And I think that, you know, we in New York, we've had a long history of fighting police brutality before I was ever involved, and I credit those people and those individuals, but we definitely need to see new people emerge.
That was Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton. Mumia Abu-Jamal is not just America's best-known political prisoner. He's also a father and a grandfather. Last week, Abu-Jamal lost his daughter to breast cancer. Samia Goldie Abdullah was 35 years old. She was a spoken word artist, a mother of two girls, and had just finished her master's degree in social work at the University of Pennsylvania. Her father remembers.
For most of the activist world, she was Goldie, a rapper and activist, whose sweet voice could strike like bricks when she crafted a rap or sang a song. To us, she was Sammy, short for Samia, a brilliant, sparkling young woman who never ceased to surprise us. She was many things: daughter, mother, student, activist, artist, orator, rapper, graduate, and more. To us, she was the baby, the youngest, and as such, she had a special shine. It's a funny thing. To a parent, a child is always a child, even when they're no longer a child. In the mind's eye, they're still a child behind the face and form of an adult. For the last 3 or 4 years, Samia was quite ill, bone cancer that spread throughout her body. For years, she had pain in her back, but she bulled through it, thinking it would heal itself. In 2011, she finally went in for examination and found what no one expected to find: cancer. She did what she always did. She fought for life despite diagnosis. In fact, she was in her hospital bed, finishing up her psychology studies, forcing herself to graduate with a master's degree. Her entire graduating class saluted her will to prevail. She fought for years against the invasion of cancer, the wretched chemotherapies, and wrenching pain. Still, she fought. What strength this little woman had. A song came to me, again, of her as a child.
As long as I breathe, I'll remember this scene. Your little fists banging like hammers, banging on the glass, slam it almost crash, tears falling like rain. Little one, oh my little one, how could I ever forget that day? You shouted, break it, it rang like a bell all day. It's been a lifetime since you're banging with your fist, and you're not a little girl anymore. You shouted, break it. You shouted, break it. How could I ever forget that day? You shouted, break it. You shouted, break it. It rings like a bell every day. I know it's been a lifetime ago. You're not a baby anymore. But as long as I breathe, I remember this scene. Your little fists banging like hammers, banging on the glass, slam it almost crash, tears are falling like rain. Little one, oh my little one, how could I ever forget that day? You shouted, break it, break it. It rings like a bell all day. It rings like a bell all day.
Samia and I never finished this song. As she breathed her last, she was sitting on her mother's lap, just as she did as a child. No longer a child, yes, but a child again. Samia Abdullah's song has ended, but like the sweetest music, it remains with us, repeating rhythms and refrains. She remains with us, echoing in our souls. She is a song we will sing. forever.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.